From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm your host, Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we're going to be having a conversation with New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak about the judicial history and future of same-sex marriage in the United States.
And it's a little hard to believe that the court, although it might want to, will be able to stay out of this issue much longer. So I would not be surprised if in the next Supreme Court term, the one that ends in June of 2015, we have a decision on that ultimate larger question of, is there a constitutional right to same-sex marriage?
That conversation, your summary of the day's top local headlines and more, just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. First up, though, this news from the BBC. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up a little bit later on the show, a conversation with New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak about same-sex marriage in the courts. But first up, we have these headlines. One of three Republican candidates vying to replace longtime Democratic Congressman Jim Matheson is dropping out of the race. Jennifer Johnson, the founder and manager of an investment company and a state board of education member, announced Monday that she was dropping out of the 4th Congressional District race. Johnson told the Salt Lake Tribune and Deseret News that she has decided it was not the right time for her to run. She declined to endorse another GOP candidate. Johnson would have faced Saratoga Springs Mayor Mia Love and former U.S. West executive Bob Feuer for the Republican nomination at the party's April 26th nominating convention. Utah's 4th Congressional District covers a string of Salt Lake City suburbs stretching south along the Wasatch Front to San Pete County. The U.S. Forest Service is backing one of the last U.S. ski resorts to prohibit snowboarding in a court battle over the ban. Attorneys for the Forest Service say in court arguments filed this week that the decision by the ski area Alta to promote a snowboarder-free experience to lure skiers is a rational finding that violates no constitutional rights. Four snowboarders filed the lawsuit in federal court in January. They're claiming discrimination on national forest lands that make up most of the Alta ski area in Little Cottonwood Canyon. The Forest Service brief comes a week after Alta lawyers argued that the lawsuit degrades the U.S. Constitution and should be thrown out. Attorneys for the snowboarders say both filings mischaracterize the complaint, confuse applicable law, and avoid the key issues. And finally today, Salt Lake City police say they've arrested two people on suspicion of human trafficking after a woman reported she was forced into prostitution before escaping in downtown Salt Lake City. Authorities announced Monday that they'd arrested 26-year-old Jean Joseph and 24-year-old Tara Pinnock in the case. Police Detective Robin Hyden says officers found a 23-year-old woman in a downtown parking lot after she called 911 on Sunday night. Police say the woman told them she was kidnapped 2 or 3 weeks ago on a New York City street and was beaten so badly she lost consciousness. She says she tried unsuccessfully to escape in Denver from a man who was driving a black Mercedes-Benz. The woman has been taken to the hospital. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. The past year has seen some watershed moments in the judicial battle over same-sex marriage in the United States. In June of last year, the Supreme Court ruled that a portion of the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, which denied federal benefits to same-sex couples, was unconstitutional. At the same time, the court reaffirmed a ruling by a lower court that struck down the state of California's ban on same-sex marriage. Citing those rulings, in December, a federal judge found that Utah's Amendment 3, defining marriage as being between a man and a woman, was unconstitutional. Legal same-sex marriages took place in the state for 17 days before the Supreme Court granted a stay to lawyers for the state of Utah, pending an appeal of the federal ruling that overturned Amendment 3. A hearing on that appeal is scheduled for April 10th in the Federal Appellate Court in Denver. And now on The Rundown, we're joined by Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times, to get an overview of the judicial history of same-sex marriage in the U.S. and to hear about the arguments being made by its proponents and detractors. Adam, thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Great to be here.
So to begin with, let's talk about some of the key moments in the judicial evolution of the issue of same-sex marriage, both at the federal level and from the perspective of individual states. When did this issue begin to be debated in the courts, and where did that happen?
Sure, we're about 20 years into it. In 1993, Hawaii briefly flirted with the idea of allowing same-sex marriage, and that gave rise to an enormous backlash, with lots of states adopting constitutional amendments forbidding same-sex marriage, and with the federal government passing the Defense of Marriage Act. So 20 years ago, there was a brief flurry of activity that essentially completely backfired. Then fast forward 10 years, and you get the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court allowing same-sex marriage in Massachusetts.
And this is in 2003, is that correct?
That's right, 2003. And that, too, seemed like it was going to be an idiosyncratic outlier. It was not greeted with a lot of enthusiasm around the nation. There are people who thought it helped contribute to John Kerry's defeat at the polls in the presidential election, that it might have driven evangelical Christians and others to the polls. So even 10 years ago, this didn't seem like a very promising idea. And the progress since then has been just incredible by the standards of any American social movement.
And a lot of that has to do with changing public opinion. I don't know if you can comment on this, but what do you think is the reason for that pendulum sway in public opinion?
Part of it is that as people came out of the closet, as gay men and lesbians started to be friends and neighbors and colleagues of other people, attitudes started to change. And the Massachusetts experience is also an example of that. When most people in Massachusetts saw that allowing same-sex couples to marry didn't seem to bring with it any negatives and maybe brought with it significant positives, that may have also changed attitudes as well.
Okay. And then as a result of that decision to legalize same-sex marriage in Massachusetts, a number of states began to take the initiative to place bans on the practice in their own states. Is that correct?
That's right. So just as with Hawaii, the Massachusetts experience gives rise to a significant backlash.
And then maybe we'll skip forward a number of years to last year when we had the Windsor and Prop 8 decisions, which have essentially allowed for some successful challenges to state bans on same-sex marriages. Is that assessment right?
Yeah. And even there, we're fast-forwarding maybe a touch too fast. In the meantime, between the Massachusetts ruling and Windsor, a decade, gradually, New England states and Iowa, in various ways, start to come on board, so that I forget the exact number, but by the time of the decision, we'd grown to maybe 11 or 12 states with same-sex marriage. So there was a significant societal movement. The decision itself is interesting because it, of course, doesn't decide the ultimate question of is there a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, but only the much narrower question of should the federal government be allowed to discriminate against those same-sex couples who are married in states that allow such unions. That's a very different question from can the federal government compel states that don't want to recognize same-sex marriage to do so. And the reasoning in the Windsor decision was also kind of pointed in two directions. Part of it bowed very strongly toward the federalism interest of letting states do for themselves what they want. But another side of the same decision also recognized the dignity of these relationships and the harm that government disapproval does to families headed by same-sex couples.
You know, that ultimate decision as to whether or not the federal government will have to recognize across the board same-sex marriages, as you say, that hasn't been decided. When are we likely to see that decision made?
Well, now we're up to the point you were talking about a second ago, Roger, where we've had this flurry of federal trial court judges striking down state bans in Utah, Oklahoma, Virginia, Michigan, and Texas. And it's a little hard to believe that the court, although it might want to, will be able to stay out of this issue much longer. So I would not be surprised if in the next Supreme Court term, the one that ends in June of 2015, we have a decision on that ultimate larger question of, is there a constitutional right to same-sex marriage?
The decisions that struck down those bans on same-sex marriage are now being challenged by various states, like Utah, in appeals courts. How much will what happens in the appellate court play into the Supreme Court's eventual ruling, whatever the federal appeals court decides?
I don't think at this point any court is going to introduce a new surprising concept that has been so far overlooked into the legal discussion. But I think a couple things will matter on the question of whether the court takes a case. One of those things is, does a federal appeals court strike down a state constitutional ban? If it does, that's a big deal, and the Supreme Court will likely step in. A second is, will federal appeals courts around the country come to different conclusions? And if they do, the court's likely to step in because it views its role very often as resolving so-called circuit splits between different federal appeals courts.
All right, a clarifying role for the court there. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the challenge the state of Utah has in the appeals court. But before we go into that, I thought maybe we could talk about what the granting of a stay by the Supreme Court in our case here in Utah, what that decision did in terms of same-sex marriage and its legality here in Utah.
Well, so I can answer that question, or try to at least, on two different levels. What it did as a practical matter to that, I forget now, roughly 1,000 couples who got married in the meantime, that remains to be seen. The analogy in California, where California for a little while allowed same-sex marriage and then the voters overturned it, those initial marriages, California now allows it for everybody, but there was a time cohort got married and then marriage was banned. Those marriages continued to be recognized. So if that analogy works, whatever happens in the appeals court, whatever happens in the Supreme Court, it may well be that those marriages will be recognized for all purposes. The state has so far taken the attitude of, we don't think so. The federal government has taken the attitude of, we're going to recognize those marriages. So that's kind of in flux, and that's one way of answering your question. A second is, what was the Supreme Court thinking of stepping in and issuing a stay when both the trial court and the federal appeals court, the Tenth Circuit, was prepared to allow marriages to go forward? My guess is it doesn't mean very much. It's just that the Supreme Court is happier to freeze the status quo and get to that question in due course without the facts on the ground changing too much in the meantime.
Okay. So, you know, as I mentioned, the decisions that struck down the bans on same-sex marriage are being challenged in federal appellate courts. You've written about the state of Utah's arguments in that particular case, and I was wondering if you wouldn't mind trying to lay out those arguments as well as what the plaintiffs are arguing for our listeners, if that's something that you're able to do.
Right. So with this idea that whenever the government discriminates against two sets of people and that discrimination is challenged in court, it has to come up with a reason. It has to explain why it's valuable to discriminate. And Utah has thrown several arguments at the wall, and they've all of them been subject to criticism. They tend to rely on social science research, which is contested and controversial, but some of it, Utah says, indicates that children are better off when they're raised by one mother and one father. And as I say, I don't know that that reflects a majority view among social scientists. Almost everyone agrees that an intact family with two parents is probably better than a single parent.
And that's irrespective of whether they're same-sex or opposite-sex couples raising these children, I guess.
But these are controversial matters. And I think where the state runs into, you can then ask the question, well, let's assume that's true. How does excluding same-sex couples from marriage advance that interest? How do you make it more likely that opposite-sex mothers and fathers will be parents when the state allows same-sex couples to raise children? And there's a kind of logical gap there that's a little hard to see your way through. They've also, and some people thought this was kind of amusing, relied on a case that would not be the first one to come to mind when you're talking about these issues, the Supreme Court's decisions in the context of affirmative action in admissions decisions in higher education, where the court has recognized the value in educational diversity. The state argues that that value of educational diversity has an analog in this situation, and that, to call it matrimonial diversity, that it's a good reason to exclude same-sex couples from marriage because we should want gender diversity in our marriages.
Well, and the very concept of gender diversity in marriage could be considered a little, I guess, amusing, because does a pair of genders, or I guess you could argue that there are more than a pair of genders out there, but does that constitute quote-unquote diversity? Or, you know, it seems like a tough argument to make.
these are, I don't want to minimize the deeply felt beliefs by people who think traditional marriage is the only way to do things. And they rely on the truth that for millennia, it's really the only kind of marriage recognized in most cultures, and that there is a powerful tradition, which may well be some sort of governmental interest, tradition alone. It's also the case that Utah's voters, democratically, voted overwhelmingly to ban same-sex marriage. So those two interests, you know, letting the people decide, tradition, those are the beginnings of an argument, but they're probably not enough to overcome any kind of more demanding scrutiny from the courts. And then you have to come up with these supplemental arguments about what's special about opposite sex marriage. And there, I think the state will have a harder time convincing the courts.
Well, I wonder, actually, and Adam, you bring up a good point, and those are arguments worth examining. But I wonder whether or not in other cases, say, you know, at the Supreme Court level, that tradition in itself has been a characteristic that allowed for rulings in favor of one thing or another. That question's a little bit convoluted, but...
It's not such a bad question. It depends, and here I have to lapse into a little bit of legalese.
Sure.
It depends on what standard of review the court's using. Most laws which don't target disfavored minorities only need to overcome a very small hurdle called rational basis review. And tradition might well be enough in that setting. In cases addressing disfavored minorities like people with disabilities or racial groups or ethnic groups or religious groups, the court asks for more demanding standards. It was certainly argued to the court when Virginia tried to defend its ban on interracial marriage that tradition was on its side, and that was not enough for the court. So tradition alone is probably enough in a setting where the law doesn't target a disfavored minority. But it may well not be enough if we're talking about a disfavored minority like race or gender. Now, the court has not said whether gay men and lesbians fit into that category of a disfavored minority, or at least not explicitly. But I think it's likely whether, in so many words or not, require more demanding scrutiny and a better reason than traditional alone.
You know, Adam, you have written about the state of Utah's shifting legal stance from, say, gender diversity to promoting procreation. Have lawyers for the plaintiffs had to change their arguments or changed their arguments at all?
I don't think the basic legal arguments have changed. There's been a lot of disagreement about strategy, about how fast to move, about where to file suit. But the basic legal arguments are fundamental constitutional arguments. One is that marriage is a fundamental right, and the government should have good reason to exclude people from it. The other is the Equal Protection Clause, that the government needs a good reason to treat different people differently.
You know, since we last spoke, we saw Texas and Michigan go through more or less the same process as Utah did, with varying windows in which same-sex marriage was legal. Is there a kind of momentum that happens in the courts? You know, aside from kind of obvious case law references and citations, we kind of like to think of the courts as operating in this legal vacuum. But is it the case that each engenders the other, or can we chalk this all up to the DOMA and Prop 8 rulings? I don't know if that question makes sense.
No, it makes good sense. On the one hand, there seems to be a consensus about how to read the Windsor decision. It's not the only possible reading of it, but the consensus view seems to be that the Supreme Court has, in a way, endorsed same-sex marriage in that ultimate way we were talking about before. Now, the other thing I might say, or repeat what a law professor said to me, is that if you are a federal judge in 2014 and you want your grandchildren to think well of you, you may not want to put your name on an opinion that the trend suggests will in short order look like bigotry.
So I guess you could say that in some ways this is sort of a legacy decision for them in the long run.
I think so. I think so. I mean, it really depends on the circles you run in, but the polling suggests that it's not only on the coasts, but that young people nationwide are moving toward overwhelmingly thinking of same-sex marriage as an easy question and as a fundamental question of civil rights.
Well, Adam Liptak is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. He joined us via Skype today. Adam, thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us here on The Rundown.
It was terrific to be here. Good to be here.
And you can find this conversation as well as all of the past interviews we've had on the program at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. You're tuned into The Rundown. We'll be right back. The Rundown was produced, as always, by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow, KCPW begins its 10-day pledge drive, but you don't have to wait till then to show your support for The Rundown. Go online to make a pledge right now, kcpw.org, and thank you. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks also for tuning in. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are next.